I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. This week, I talked to Lindsay Boyle about an overdose death at a New London sober house and the death's effect on those left behind, including the deceased's mother, the sober house manager, and other residents. Ben Kale attended a youth summit at Waterford High School that featured an inspirational speaker who showed off his harmonica beatboxing skills. And Martha Shanahan says kelp is the new kale, as she visited a couple of local kelp farming operations. In fact, she says she reached right into the water, pulled out the slimy brown plant, and took a couple of big bites. Lindsay, tell me what happened on Press Street.
Oddly enough, I was actually covering a different breaking news story, which was that police had surrounded the Red Roof Inn off of Coleman Street because of a shooting suspect, or a suspect in a Wyndham shooting was there. So I was actually on the field there, and I had just gotten all the details. In that case, I was sitting in my car filing the story from my phone. That's what we do. When I had the scanner app going on my other phone, two phones, man, it's really nice. But the scanner app was going on my other phone, and I heard a call for an untimely death at 47 Press Street. And immediately I was like, oh no, I've been to 47 Press Street. I've sat in a couch on 47 Press Street. 47 Press Street is one of two homes on Press Street, sober homes. That actually are trying to work out this model where you start at one home and have more oversight, and then you graduate to the second home where you have a little bit more freedom once you've proven that, and once you've earned it, more or less. And it's a place where I can definitely say that the house manager does care. We hear horrifying things about sober homes, horrifying stories of neglect. This was not one of those places, and the guys who are there really like it. So as soon as I heard that, I was like, no, oh no, it's bad anywhere, but this was going to be tough. So I filed my story about the Wyndham shooting suspect and drove to Press Street, where sure enough, I saw Chuck, the house manager, walking down the street. He's someone that I had sat with the last time I was in 47 Press Street. So, I went over and said hello. Sorry, we have to meet again on these terms. And I just hung out. I hung out on the street. It was cold. My hands went numb. My feet went numb. But I just stood there and watched. I watched the man who found the deceased. The deceased is Zachary Ramsdell, by the way, 30. He was 30. The man who found Zachary was in hysterics, just rocking back and forth in his car. He could hardly speak. Another resident who I later spoke with, Fred Wallen, was just pacing the sidewalk. He just couldn't believe it. Chuck was trying to talk to police, and it was so sad. And so I just kind of stood, and I was a fly on the wall for quite some time. Obviously, I ended up going into the home, talking to a couple of the guys and the victim's mother for the story that ended up being in Thursday's paper.
What's his name again?
Zachary Ramsdell.
So,
tell me a little bit about Zachary. What's his story and how
he ended up the way he did?
So, with this story, I kind of took a different approach than I have in the past, because I think people are growing tired of the stories that say who this kid was and how this happened to him. I didn't actually ask a lot of those questions, not because we can assume what happened, but because I wanted to tell a different story here, which is that these sober homes are kind of like, I don't want to say a double-edged sword. There are good things and bad things, right? There are guys who and gals who want to be in a community where they're supported and they have people who understand them. I think that's really important. And there are plenty of people who want sober homes, but there are also issues with sober homes that I kind of alluded to earlier. where there's no oversight, where drugs are actually being sold in the homes, things like that. So anyway, the point of all of this is to say, I wanted to focus on how this was by all accounts, a good sober home. And I don't think more regulations would have changed this outcome. So this makes it very tough. If we want to regulate sober homes as the solution, but what would that have done Tuesday at Press Street? Maybe if there was a full-time employee at the place, but then is it even a sober home anymore? I don't know. So I kind of wanted to get at that issue of, this is way more complicated than just signing sober homes up on a registry. That's a good start, probably. Getting certified is definitely a good start. But these guys cared. They had someone they could call. They had naloxone on site, and this still happened. So I don't know too much about exactly when Zachary started using drugs. I do know that he sounded like a super normal kid. He loved playing basketball and soccer. His dad coached his teams. His dad passed away in 2011, and I believe that Zachary took that pretty hard. And I did look, you know, I have to do my research, so I did look into his criminal background, which also began in the year 2011. So I think that the dad dying was an impetus, but he seemed like the kind of guy who wanted everyone around him to be better and feel better. Everyone described him as an uplifter, as someone who was really struggling with mental illness, but still wanted to spend time on other people. That really struck me. These guys telling his story were absolutely devastated by losing someone that they'd only known since January.
They create a relationship. I mean, all of them are dealing with very similar issues, so they create some kind of relationship. And in your story, it's mentioned that he had a rough day, and they kind of worked it out and ended up posting something on Facebook. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So this, the part of the model at these two sober homes is that they have regular meetings where it's kind of just informal, like get it off your chest type of meetings, because that's really what the house manager Chuck is trying to foster, is like, you need to talk about it, we can work it out. You feel like relapsing, call me, we can work it out. You know, Zachary was kind of a shy guy, but he opened up in these meetings, and he felt comfortable around the people in these homes. So I guess he had said to a couple of them that he was having a bad day on Monday. And, you know, that actually ended up leading to Fred Wallen, one of the residents, staying up with him and watching TV until 4 in the morning. But Fred was telling me this, and Fred said, you know, they talked it out, and then they talked about nothing, and, you know, they just joked around, and they were having a fine time. You know, Fred said that Zachary had planned to go to some kind of meeting. Nothing bad. He was going to go to a meeting in the morning. He had plans. It didn't sound like he had plans to go overdose in the morning. So even the people who were closest to him, no one saw this coming, really. All of them were just blaming themselves. That was actually what struck me the most, is that in retrospect, they still couldn't find any signs, but yet they all were like, oh, I should have gotten up earlier, or I shouldn't have given him $40. I should have done something differently, and this would have been different. It's really hard to sit and hear someone say that, because of course you want to encourage them, like, no, don't put the blame on yourself, but you also understand why they are blaming themselves.
What is the thinking behind having a sober house in an area that is, you know, notorious for having crime issues and illegal drug issues?
Right. You know, I thought about addressing that in my piece, and I maybe should have. It was just getting, a little long. In my first meeting with Chuck and the fellows of these houses, we talked about that, because we thought it was kind of nuts. But to be honest, And they said, you know, one of the things that they did when they purchased these properties, and I mean Chuck and the people who are helping him in this project, which is not his full-time job, for the record, one of the things they did was to go up and down Press Street and clean it, like literally just pick up trash. They introduced themselves. They said what they were doing. The homes that they bought, or at least one of them, previously was a total drug house. And Press Street's reputation continues, although, you know, to hear Chuck tell it, it's changed a little bit. I know it sounds funny because it's a short street, but the bottom of the street seems to be cleaning up a little bit. So their idea was that they could, by putting these sober homes in this area, they replaced two drug homes, right? Maybe the next door neighbors or the nearby neighbors would see that they're cleaning up the street and they're caring about it. And maybe they'll push some more drug homes out, right? And to the point of putting addicts close to drugs, oh, come on. If you're an addict, you know where to get drugs. If you want drugs, you get drugs. Right. You know, if it's up the street, is it easier? Certainly.
Or around the corner.
Right.
Or,
yeah, I mean. But, I mean, if you're going to relapse, there's a lot more going on than just accessibility. There's a lot more that has happened to you that, you know, that doesn't have to do with the availability.
Right. And the location, necessarily. Well, thank you for stopping by, and yeah, let's in a future episode talk more about sober homes and legislation.
Yeah, I'll keep you posted.
Thank you.
So this week, Waterford High School hosted a youth summit for middle and high school students from every town in the area. The event was organized by Southeastern Regional Action Council and the Adolescent Learning and Leadership Institute. Both these groups educate communities on issues around substance abuse and avoiding risky behaviors. And the students at the summit talked about ways to combat bullying, addiction, vaping, and the negativity of social media sometimes. One of the keynote speakers was a motivational speaker and beatboxer, Josh Dreen, who he entertained the students by mimicking drums and other instruments, in some cases animals, into the mic. He also told an inspiring story about when he started learning harmonica in high school. The kids teased him because it wasn't a cool instrument. Kids wanted to learn guitar. They wanted to learn drums, not harmonica. But he stuck with it. And then he showed the kids, you know, what he could do. And it was one of those, you know, many resonating messages about how to overcome negativity and create something positive.
Because there will be a point in your life where the thing for which you were made fun of is the thing for which you are praised. So instead of giving up, I learned how to do this.
Tell me about kelp farming.
Yeah, kelp farming. Kelp is the new kale, supposedly, although not everyone agrees with that. So there's three people who are have been working on developing kelp farming, as in farming seaweed for human consumption. For a few years now, it's a very difficult thing to plant, like to seed and harvest. It all happens in open water, and requires a certain amount of equipment and hard work. But it's something that seems to sort of be spreading and increasing in popularity, especially as a way for people involved in shellfishing or people involved in sort of water-based industries to make revenue over the winter when you otherwise wouldn't be. So, for example, one of the, so there's three people who will be harvesting kelp for the first time, and sort of producing a harvest of kelp out of the Fisher's Island Sound this spring, so probably in about a month. They'll all be doing that. It all has to do with the water temperature. One of them is a couple that owns a marina in Stonington, and so they're using those, that access to the water that they have, and the equipment that they already have to try harvesting kelp as a way to get an income, because they're not making a lot of money on owning the marina during the winter.
Right.
Another guy is someone who's connected with that couple in Stonington, and he is part of a sort of larger sort of co-op effort to get more people involved in sort of sustainable aquatic farming involving kelp and shellfish. So he has a whole organization that he's sort of all over the place. But he personally has a lease for a bit of water area, sort of off of Bluff Point in Groton. And then there's another independent farmer who's had a career in shellfishing, and got a lease from the state to start. He has a sort of little area, also off of Bluff Point, where he's going to be harvesting some kelp. I went out with him. His name, that third guy that I mentioned is named JP Velotti, and I went out with him on his boat so we could take some pictures of the kelp and check it out and see what it looks like. Right now it looks like some buoys floating in the water. Right. That's about all you can see. You can boat through it. And he pulled up the ropes that the kelp is growing on and showed it to us. It's not extremely appetizing looking,
right,
when you bring it out of the water.
It's a little slimy looking.
It's brown. Right. It turns green when you cook it. I did try some.
Uh-huh. In what form?
Straight off of the rope, out of the water.
Right out of the water.
Right out of the water.
Don't you have to wash it?
No, I mean, it...
So salty.
It was pretty salty, yeah.
It came out of the salt water.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had, like...
You've had, like, seaweed, yeah.
Seaweed salad and little bits that are in, like, the soups. And,
yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's used a lot for broth.
Right.
And boiled in soups for flavor. It's certainly not fit for, like, a main dish or, like, you know, like, I'm just going to eat myself a big plate of seaweed.
Seaweed sandwich.
Yeah, there's no protein in it, so it's not... Yeah, seaweed sandwich. There's no protein in it, so it's not something that you would serve at a restaurant as like a meal in itself.
Right.
But I think it's used for flavoring, and it's used sort of as a garnish for various things. These guys seem to think that these farmers seem to think that there's enough of a market for it. I'm not sure about the other ones, but I know that JP said he's going to be harvesting about 5,000 pounds of it. And one of the things I think that they have to get over is people's either ignorance or disinterest in eating kelp. I was out there with one of our photographers, Sean Elliott, and we had very different reactions to the idea of putting this brown, slimy vegetable in our mouths. I was very happy to do it, and I took several big bites of it and sort of thought about what it tasted like, and JP offered some to Sean and he declined. He said, and he told me later, that he's eaten kelp and was not interested in eating it anymore.
Well, I mean, yeah, most people's interaction with kelp is like something that you you're at the beach, you got to kind of get it tangled
yeah,
in your feet.
Yeah, you don't want to step on it. Yeah.
Trying to shake it off your foot or
yeah,
whatever.
It's yeah, it's all sandy. Yeah. Yeah. So it's, and when it's growing in this kind of semi-controlled environment, it's a little bit less, it's sort of, it's almost translucent. It's okay. Kind of, it's kind of pretty. I yeah, mean, it's brown, but it's kind of, you know, it's a little bit more delicate than what you would sort of pick up at the beach.
Does the farming of kelp in any way complement their usual business of like shelf farming or whatever it is that they usually do?
It uses some similar equipment. I mean, if you have a boat that helps that you're already using, and sort of a knowledge of the, you know, water temperatures and, that kind of stuff. There are some farms that are doing both, mm-hmm, right now. It's kind of a similar mindset, I guess, is sort of they're, you know, it's a sustainable crop, and it involves a lot of, you know, paying very close attention to the seed and how it's growing, and the main difference I think between the shellfish and the kelp is that the shellfish don't require any processing. You just gotcha, right, you know, you have them and then you sell them, right. At least around here, the, you know, local shellfish market is they just sell them directly right, to, well, they'll sell them to a distributor who will send them to restaurants wherever on the East Coast. And kelp takes a little bit more work because, most of the market is for processed, right, is for processed kelp. And
it's not for people to just take a bite out of it like you did.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't think that. I don't
could you swim out to their little farm and just start
you could
chomping?
Nibble on it, I guess, if you wanted. It's state water, so it's public.
Yeah.
It's a public property.
You're hungry and you're at one of these beaches, just take a swim out.
Yeah, yeah. It might be a little bit cold still. Right. Apparently, they were slightly concerned about whether seals would be trying to eat it. Apparently, seals don't like it, though, so that's not a problem. And fish, so far, I think, have left it alone. But that's part of the reason that they have to take it all out before it gets too warm, is that things will, other like algae will start to grow on it,
right,
and mussels will start to want to grow on it, yeah, and make it not very attractive for
them,
for selling. Yeah. Kelp.